Good evening for those of you who are here in the evening. Good afternoon for those of you who are in the afternoon. And good morning for some of you who are either up very late or up very early. It's, of course, delightful to be here. And I'm very still, a part of me is contemplating the presidential inauguration, which, of course, happened this morning. And it feels like a very auspicious day, not least because our new vice president, Kamala Devi Harris, is named after the goddess Lakshmi, which must be a sign of healing, right? I wept through the inauguration, which maybe some of you do. I always find myself weeping at patriotic rituals, especially when they're singing songs, whether it's America the Beautiful or the Marseillaise or Land of Hope and Glory or Jerusalem or Deutschland über alles, those, you know, the kind of civic religion, which is really, I think, what these ceremonies are about, is deeply moving. You know, despite all the ways our governments disappoint us, despite the terrible political tensions currently in the U.S., there's really so much hope and beauty in these moments. On a deeper level, and I think we've said this before, it's really clear that we're in the midst of a tectonic shift that's going on all over the planet, all over the globe, very strongly in several of the Western democracies. There's a transformation of consciousness happening, and because it's a big one and it's a mysterious one, and because it's upending so much of what we think of as normal, there's also a tremendous backlash, not just fear and insecurity on the part of people who are fundamentally allied with this consciousness shift, but also the deep resistance and backlash of people who feel like it's taking something away from them. I've found that it's really important whether you're thinking about the, you know, the civic upheavals, the political upheavals, or whether you're experiencing upheavals inside, which of course many of us are. It's really important to recognize that where there is something going on in the collective consciousness, going to affect our consciousness, because ultimately we're not separate from it. So even if you live in quiet, peaceful enclaves where you don't have to see a lot of people, which I do, or if you stay off social media, if you don't pay attention to the news, still these events affect you, simply because we can't separate our own consciousness from the collective consciousness. This is one of the reasons, of course, that many of you, and certainly me, are drawn to studying these texts, which are all about how you keep your consciousness and such that you're not tossed all over the place in your own mind by what's going on in the world, and also so that you can learn how to ride the energies of this time in what we could call an upward-moving direction rather than letting them take you down into fear or despair. One of the questions that came in on the listserv, or came in privately actually, was from someone who was talking about how her empathy for individuals, by extension for, you know, the global situation, was somehow resulting in her taking on the effects of other people's suffering, especially physical suffering. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the topic of empathy versus compassion, and later on we're going to do a compassion meditation, which is one of the practices that this part of the text talks about. Empathy is vital, of course. It's a beautiful emotional experience where we're able to tune into others' pain, very much a part of our humanity. It's what keeps us from hurting other people. It's what helps us feel close to other people. And sometimes it can, you know, actually be a source of help for other people. But empathy is an emotion, which means that it's felt not just in the mind, but in the whole body and often the pain we take on from others causes physical and mental suffering for us that we don't always understand because we don't realize that it's not coming from our own disease, but coming from our empathic connection with somebody else. So empathy can create difficulties. Compassion, on the other hand, even though the English word compassion means feeling with, it's actually the capacity for being present with others' suffering and our own without trying to fix it. You know, in the Eastern traditions, the quality of compassion, karuna, is sometimes described as the quality of an awakened mind, an enlightened citta. Bodhicitta is one of the names for the kind of understanding that leads to compassion. And it's a capacity for being present with another's suffering without losing ourselves in their suffering, because it comes out of a wider view. Now, in the Brazilian shamanistic traditions, there's a practice that I want to offer you where you cultivate compassion by stationing yourself in the region of what in my tradition we call the outer heart. It's about 9 to 12 inches in front of your heart center. And in this region, which is an aspect of your subtle body, you can find the felt sense of compassion, the strength, really, to be present with the suffering of another person, to just hold space for it. And as many of you know, it's in that space that actual healing can start to happen by the mingling of your loving awareness with theirs. This is where healing can actually begin to occur. And you don't have to try and fix it. You can just be present in this state of compassion, and compassion itself will help. Developing that space is done through a form of samyama, so we're going to do that later on. And what we're talking about this week is a section of Book 3. It's actually Sutras 17 to 51, which are all about samyama. We're going to talk about it quite a bit this week. We're going to work with it in homework assignment because it's not only a really significant way of going deeper in meditation, it's also extremely practical. And many of you have done a lot of work with samyama. You may be aware of it or not, but hopefully after we've done this study, you will be. It's in through the practice of samyama that we're not only able to go deeper in our inner journey, it also helps us to learn. It helps us to manifest positive realities. And it really is the key to creating breakthrough in your outer life as well as in the inner. In the spirit of Joe Biden's inauguration, let's take a moment to dedicate our practice. And let's do it from that space of compassion. So bring your attention about a foot in front of your heart, moving your hand out there. See if you can move your hand just very gently so that and bring your mind to where your hand is, and you'll notice that there is a space here that you'll kind of key into that actually connects to the heart, but it also connects to this field outside. With our awareness there, let's dedicate our practice tonight for the ending of the pandemic, for the afterlife journeys of those who've passed on, for the grief and the fear that so many people have. Let's dedicate our practice to our leaders in all the nations of the world, asking that they have the grace to make wise decisions, decisions that come from the place of prajna, of intuitive insight, and actually to receive the guidance that arises from the subtle realms. now you can find yourself in your meditative posture, sitting upright, allowing the downward motion of the inhalation to ground you through the sit bones, allowing the upward movement of the exhalation to lift your body through the torso. And feel the subtle presence that we have cultivated through so many months of imagining ourselves at the sacred lake, the Lake Manasarovar, deep in the Himalayas. Powerful blue lake, deep as consciousness is deep, surrounded by all of us who are here together, with friends and loved ones who may not be in the course, but who you feel close to, also present around the lake. Inhale and exhale as you feel into the energy of the sacred spa. As you inhale, feel that you're inhaling the energy of the lake and the energy of all of us, our virtual community. And as you exhale, feel that the distractions, the worries, the stray thoughts are being breathed out and dissolved in the sacred waters of the lake. You hold in your hand a candle in a jeweled holder. And as you look into the flame of the candle, create an intention for this class, an intention for the week, and because we're still very early in the year, if you're moved to do it, place in it your intention for yourself, for your family and friends, for the world, any or all. Place that in the candle. And then ask that your immersion in practice tonight be a benefit to all beings. And then bring the candle to your heart. And with a feeling of reverence, place it in the water of the lake. We ask that our practice uplift us, carry us further into our journey to enlightenment. We ask that it give us wisdom, comfort, and peace. We ask that our practice enable us to be of help for others. And now we'll chant the mantras Om Namah Shivaya Gurave, starting with three Oms, and then the traditional Patanjali invocation mantras. You can place your hands in Anjali Mudra or your right hand on top of your sternum, your heart center, and your left hand on top of that, feeling the connection of your palms with each other or with your heart. And we'll take a deep inhalation together. Shivaya Gurave Sat Chit Ananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. Salutations to Shiva, the eternal teacher, who exists within all of us as pure being, pure awareness, pure joy, who is peaceful, luminous, without form, who is never not supporting us. Now the Patanjali mantras. Ande Gurunam Charanaravinde Sandarshita Swatma Sukhava Bodhe Nishreyase Jangalikayamane Samsara Hala Halama Mohashantye Abahu Purushakaram Shankachakra Siddharinam Sahasra Shirasam Shvetam Paranamami Patanjalim Paranamami Patanjalim. I bow to the lotus feet of the Gurus, the awakening happiness of one's own self revealed. Supremely good, acting like the miracle healer, pacifying delusion and the poison of samsara, taking the form of a man serpent holding a conch, a discus, and a sword, 1,000 heads, white, to Patanjali, I bow. Now, allow yourself to feel the presence of each other, the energy emanating from the Great Lake, and the sense of your body in space. Your body being held by the space that holds us all. And begin to bring your attention to the breath flowing in through the nostrils, flowing horizontally and slightly upward through the nasal passages, beginning to find with the breath the soft palate, the doorway to the Talu Chakra. Your tongue is relaxed on the floor of the mouth. And as you allow the breath to flow through the nostrils, see if you can feel the sensuality of it, the actual space of the journey that the breath takes up through the nostrils, rising slightly into the soft palate, and then flowing through the soft palate into the center of the head behind the forehead, which is the Ajna Chakra, the seat of the higher mind, the command center that allows us to begin to expand consciousness beyond our normal limits. Just for now, be present with the breath. Let it rise into the Ajna. And then as the breath, as the inhalation reaches its peak, without a pause, allow the exhalation now to bring your attention down to the heart center behind the breastbone. In this process, you're letting yourself feel the touch of the breath as the inhalation touches the soft palate and rises up into the Ajna. Feeling the luminosity that may begin to reveal itself there, and then letting the exhalation draw your awareness down towards the heart. you're invited to keep, to stay present with this movement of the breath, even as you listen. And I also want to say that a lot of the time in these classes, I believe I said it last week, but I'm going to repeat it again. A lot of the time in these classes, your mind will go very deep inside and you'll stop hearing what I'm saying. And I want you to know that that's completely fine. It's a sign that the Shakti within this contemplation is affecting you. And it just means that you need to listen to the talk again, which is one of the reasons why it's so helpful to do it this way, where we get a recording that we can hear. So samyama. Samyama is a technical term that describes what we're doing when we combine dharana, dhyana, and samadhi in the natural way that occurs as we become more and more accustomed to the process of easing into meditation. When the initial concentration, which is usually broken by a lot of thoughts, allows us to sink into dhyana, where the object of meditation, the focal point, becomes more and more present, and then into samadhi, where there is a kind of melting of the barriers between yourself and the inner experience. And at this point, it becomes possible for the mind to focus itself on anything, including very, very subtle aspects of yourself. And as we allow ourselves to practice with the space that arises in this kind of subtle focus, a kind of alchemy takes place. Samyama is the transformative protocol, so to speak, the transformative practice that draws us into the subtle states of consciousness, into the Shakti field, where real change happens and where it becomes possible to really transform the contours of reality for a moment or two. It's, you know, in meditation, this happens as you go deeper and deeper inside. We were saying last week that such a focused state may last for only a very short time in meditation, but that as you begin to learn the process of samyama, you begin to be able to flow back to it quite easily. So according to Patanjali, this is how we get to the heart of any subject, including the nature of our own soul, and actually the contemplation protocol that we're doing, that you've been given in the homework assignment for understanding the sutras, is a way of cultivating samyama. Because true samyama is a state in which you get deeper and deeper immersion in the object of meditation until the intuitive knowing about the essence of any subject is revealed to you. And, you know, we use samyama throughout life. A scientist immersing herself in studying a virus, you know, trying to find the DNA of the virus and get an intuition about what might create a vaccine or a healing, has to get to a kind of samyama in order to take the inner leap that leads to new knowledge. Even though the knowledge is based on research and observation, the intuition that creates the breakthrough comes not from the mind, but from that deeper space known as prajna. That, you know, this is the state a musician or an athlete can get into famously. It's called the zone, where there's a natural alignment with the flow of your movement or the music. True healers very often operate with a samyama practice that lets them come to an intuitive awareness of what's appropriate for the disease. So we know about samyama, even though we usually develop it in a slightly less, let's just say, less mystical form to focusing on something external. But if you've ever worked with any subject through this kind of increasingly subtle focus, you know that the intuitions you get are mystical. You know, they defy intellectual understanding often. You know, in this process, it's very much very like the threefold internal segue of dharana into samya, into dhyana, into samadhi. You know, you'll start by focusing intently on this, your subject, letting go of distractions, the problem you're trying to address, say the painting you see in your mind. And you bring all the techniques that you've learned to bear. And then you just get drawn inside. And in that state, the radical intuition arises. You get the answers as a download. You know, so the whole protocol for samyama is about focusing on what it is that you want to understand or cultivate. You know, perhaps you're making a decision as to whether or not to leave a job. So you would contemplate the decision itself, the feeling state that arises when you think of leaving, the feeling state that arises when you think of staying. And then immerse yourself in, without expectation, without preference, which is really significant, in that congruence, that junction point between leave or stay. And from that junction point, you get the answer. An intuitive knowing arises, which may have no rational basis, but which is utterly trustworthy. So, in spiritual practice, we describe this as direct realization, the kind of knowledge that arises as experience, rather than as a regurgitation or something you've read or something someone's told you. And such intuitions come from what's called the causal level of reality, which is deeper than the physical, deeper than the subtle, and which is the abode of prajna. You know, that prajna being the intuitive knowledge, the numinous intuitive knowledge filled with truth. This state is often called arittambada prajna, truth-bearing intuition. And this is clearly true in mundane matters, and it's deeply true in spiritual matters. You know, when you have a direct experience of the Atman, the self, or a direct vision of the inner lights, or an intimation of your oneness with the divine form that you worship over the universe itself, you don't need somebody else to tell you what it's like. Because you grok it, meaning you understand this level of reality as a full gestalt. In the Prabhupada commentary on the Yoga Sutra, on Sutra 17, he cites a famous story about Ramakrishna, who was once asked by his disciple Vivekananda, "Do you see God? Do you really see God?" And Ramakrishna answered, "I see God more clearly than I see you," which is pretty far out, actually. You know, what he meant was that the seeing, the darshan that you get in samyama, it's much brighter and clearer and literally luminous in a way that ordinary physical sight is not. And if you've ever had a spiritual dream or a vision in meditation, you know what I'm talking about. So this is the real deal. And Sutra 5 explains, by mastering that, samyama, the light of knowledge, intuitive faculty known as prajna, dawns. And from the state of prajna, your wisdom is really undismissible. A lot of my experience of prajna has come in writing, and it's been very important to me because when I was in my 20s working as a journalist, I would very often get stuck or blocked, partly because I was a perfectionist, partly because I often couldn't actually see what the most important thing to talk about was. So one of the immediate fruits of meditation for me is that I found that if I really wanted to express something, whether in an article or in a talk, I would sit for meditation with a question like, okay, what's the meaning of this, or what's important to say here? The answer would arise. And with an immediacy and confidence, and I know you know what I'm talking about, as I said earlier, the contemplation processes we're doing with the sutras are all about kindling this level of prajna. And to cultivate that state requires that you spend some time mastering the process, focusing, deepening your focus, and finally becoming fully immersed in it. Dharana, dhyana, and samadhi come together. And as you become more familiar with deeper states of meditation, you begin to be able to recognize when you're in a place where the question can get answered or when the prayer can become real. One of the reasons we use this technique, contemplate sutras, of course it's good in itself to contemplate sutras, but it also trains us to hear that subtle inner voice of insight that comes from prajna. So, you know, that, and this is tremendously effective and indeed understandable in meditation. You know, so you'll because the real art of meditation is learning how to follow the guidance that's deeper than the mind. That the one of the commentators on the Yoga Sutras writes, yoga teaches you yoga. My guru used to say, meditation teaches you meditation. And this is really the art of going deeper in meditation. You know, you get an instruction, and hopefully you'll follow it. But the your following of it is really more for the sake of learning it. But as you work with the instruction, as your dharana sinks into dhyana, there'll come a shift, which I know many of you know very well, which can feel like expansion or rising or settling as the object becomes stronger in you, and you begin to get very often directional nudges, like little pushes that help you get past the thought stream, that show you how to tweak the practice a little bit. And you know without knowing it, sometimes without words, where your meditation wants to take you at this moment. Several people shared on the listserv about how during the meditation on the soft palate, they would start to see a kind of luminosity and a sense of expansion, which is really a precursor to the awareness that what you really are is light. And they're also signs that you're meditating Ajna Chakra, which is a center that nature is, this extraordinary luminosity, which also carries with it wisdom and insight. And these gifts come spontaneously. They come through grace, but they also come through your focused effort. One other thing that I want to say, which is going to become useful for us in the second meditation that we're going to be doing in a few minutes. You know, we spoke last week about how even in samadhi states, the mind doesn't necessarily become completely still. And that's, first of all, because the nature of the mind is flow. We'll say more about that in a few minutes. But it's also because beneath the surface thoughts, there are these deeper impressions called samskaras. There's, you know, the scars or grooves. Abhinavagupta calls them wounds. The wounds within consciousness that are, you know, like if you take a pencil and score, you know, and press it down on a piece of paper and draw a line, the pen will form a groove that can actually leave an impression on the paper beneath the one you drew on. This is how samskaras are. And, you know, in the yoga traditions, those of us who do serious spiritual practice, which I think includes pretty much all of you, we're sort of taught that samskaras are bad, that you have to get rid of them. And of course, some scholars are very obstructive, but actually many samskaras are helpful, and especially the in other words, some of our samskaras are what help us master anything. We just develop wisdom that's lodged in the mind as grooves in the mind. But from the yogic point of view, it's said that there are two types of samskaras, the samskaras of outgoing attention, which are always colored by the inner tendencies that the Yoga Sutra calls kleshas or afflictions, and the indrawing samskaras, which arise out of practice, especially the practices of restraining thoughts. So our samskaras, whether they're the outgoing or afflicted ones, make you who you are. And one of the things, of course, about the ordinary samskaras is that they pull you to seek outside yourself for experience, for stimulation, for love. But in meditation, your inflowing samskaras, the samskaras of stillness, the samskaras of your meditative intention, are essentially always at war with the outgoing samskaras, and that's why it often takes us a while to sit in meditation, to get into meditation, because there's an argument going on between the outgoing samskaras and the inflowing samskaras. So when you sit for meditation, what you're actually doing is cultivating the samskaras of yogic restraint, or nirodha. They're actually called the nirodha samskaras. And that, you know, these get stored in the citta, and it's they that bring you back into meditation over and over again. So the second sutra of the Yoga Sutra, yoga is citta vritti nirodha, yoga is the restraint of the fluctuations of the mind, does not point to the fact that yoga is a state of stillness. It points to the work of yoga that we do when we cultivate yogic samskaras. Sutra 10 of Book 3 says, the mind's peaceful flow, the Sanskrit word is vahita, occurs due to samskaras. And I find this so important. You know, it's your samskaras of peacefulness, the ones you've cultivated, that let you experience peace. So you literally have to accumulate meditative samskaras. And I've talked often about my early experience of meditation where it was just so hard for me that I would have to sit for a long time before the outgoing samskaras would just give up. And I would begin to experience the meditative samskaras. I can remember the day, and it was quite a while. It was a couple of years, honestly, after I started meditation. I had been meditating for an hour a day for a long time. But I started to feel that when I sat down and shut my eyes, I would be in meditation. And it felt like a triumph because I had struggled so hard to do it. And I realized at that moment that it comes, that you accumulate some scars of indrawn attention, and they work for you. They take you inside. But, and another thing, we spoke a little bit about this last week, any meditation session is going to last only as long as the outgoing samskaras don't interrupt it. You know, the outgoing samskaras will interrupt your meditation maybe several times in the course of half an hour. And then the effort you make to come back is actually what cultivates the restraint. So I feel that the reason that we need to like the object we're meditating on or like the method we're using is because it does take a while for many of us to get the knack of meditation. And if we don't enjoy the object, if we don't enjoy the process, then it's going to be hard for us to actually sit. But, you know, if we do like it, because the mind is always looking for a place where it can take rest, that's why it wanders so much, a focal point that we like can provide such a resting place. And as the concentration deepens, the focused mind will just start being drawn back to the subject. So, and that brings us to the kind of deeper process that makes samyama lead to the acquisition of siddhis, of powers. So close your eyes. We're just going to practice with the soft palate and the chakra for a moment. Be aware of the flow of vayu, flow of breath through the nostrils. See if you can feel how the subtle touch of the breath paints your nasal passages. And follow the flow. Feel the subtle caress of the breath in the nasal passages. Feel it flowing up to the soft palate. And then moving inward towards the center of the head, slightly upward. And then with the exhalation, feel the breath flowing downward, meeting the heart center. See if you can surrender yourself to the flow of the breath. And just notice as your consciousness surfaces, or as you become more outgoing, what the effect of this practice is. Where is your mind at this moment? Does it want to stay up in the ajna, in the soft palate? Does it want to settle in the heart? And notice also that in every meditation session, you're having a slightly different experience than in the other meditation session that you just did, because the mind is always changing. It's the nature of the mind to change, to flow. And yet, this flowing quality of the mind, though it's more or less constant, you know, it can flow in an agitated way or it can flow in a peaceful way, but it's always flowing. And as it flows, as you follow the flow with the understanding of what the mind really is, you begin to realize that its natural flow in meditation is toward sinking into itself, into what we could call its substratum, that is, into the underlying energy out of which thoughts and images arise. And that underlying substratum of the citta eventually opens up into the true substratum of all of our experience, which is prakriti or shakti. To understand how flow is the nature of mind, and to learn how to follow its flow inward or downward or upward, or, you know, there are many directions in which the flow of the meditative mind occurs. You also recognize that the citta, like Prakriti, and all the changes of the citta are actually part of the endless flow of the three gunas, the three qualities of reality, the qualities of clarity or sattva, of activity or, you know, intensity, I would say, rajas, and stasis, tamas, which are constantly rolling through Prakriti and which kind of chase themselves in different combinations through the mind. So when your meditation is very sattvic, there's a sense of peace and clarity. This is the peaceful flow. When you're in a sattvic state, really the trick is to let yourself settle into it. And the mind is in rajas, and it's in a rajasic active form. What I found is that it's very helpful to give the mind several focal points. In other words, you focus on the breath and on, in this particular instance, on the soft palate. But you might also want to add the mantra, Hamsa is the one we've been using in this class, to the breath, so that the mind has several different focal points to cling to. And this is what we need to do when the mind is active or rajasic, because its movement is going to be more intense. And when the mind is in a tamasic state, that's when you fall asleep in meditation. So that's, you know, in tamasic states of meditation, it's very important to be willing to wake yourself up and not confuse tamasic mind states with deep meditation. The deep meditative states always have this quality of sattva, of clarity, even though there are very, you know, very thought-free states of meditation which can feel like deep sleep, but which, when you come out of them, you realize have actually been states of deep rest, because you feel more alert and awake. And these states will often chase you through a particular meditation. But if you can remember that the essence of mind is Prakriti, is Shakti, the creative force of the divine, that your citta is a field, it's a field that's capable of total expansion, and which, when you meditate, begins to open and reveal itself as part of the underlying field of Shakti or Prakriti. So really, the mind is the individual version of Prakriti or Shakti, which is the essential substance of everything. So just as a pot is made of clay and remains clay even when the pot is smashed, and just the way a bracelet is made of gold or silver, and when the metal is melted and made into something else, its essence is still gold or silver. Just as the sky remains sky even as clouds arise and dissolve, the substrate in Prakriti underlies everything, whether past, present, or future, and is always accessible. Not only is it accessible, it's the source of all your power. So, because everything is part of Prakriti, if we can touch into Prakriti through Samyama, flowing downward into the subtlest part of the mind, we connect to that part, to that aspect of our consciousness, which is fully empowered by the creative energy of the universe. And it's because this innate creativity of the mind substratum then becomes available to us, an advanced yogi can manipulate reality through a thought. And this is the core truth that lies behind the amazing claims that we discover when we read a book like Yogananda Paramahamsa's Autobiography of a Yogi, where he talks a lot about the different extraordinary powers that yogis he met had. So before we go into the sutras on siddhis, I want to do a practice that can start to connect the chitta to the expanded mind and to Prakriti herself. So if you feel like you'd like to stretch, just take a second to stretch. More than a second. You can have 10 seconds. This is a practice that I discovered in deep meditation about 20 years ago. And it actually transformed my understanding of my own mind. I have a version of it in my book, Meditation for the Love of It. But I very rarely teach it, honestly, because it's a practice that actually asks us to surrender to our own consciousness, which is not something that all of us know how to do. But I'm going to talk you through it. And I want you to, as you practice, you know, with my instructions, just see if you can let go of the judgments and the feeling of, I don't know how to do this, and just follow the natural flow of the mind, which you will begin to become aware of. So find your posture. Your eyes are closed. The breath helps you soften in the posture, which is a very beautiful and intrinsic part of meditation, inhaling downward, letting the sit bones sink, and exhaling upward, letting the upper body rise, and then allowing the mind to flow through the body. Noticing the tension that might appear and consciously softening it. And gradually bring the mind up to the ajna, to the space. Of the center of the head, and begin to look at what you see with your closed eyes. So you're not trying to manipulate your consciousness in any way. You're not trying to focus on the ajna or the nostrils. You're just looking at the field that you see with your eyes closed. And that field is, it might feel grayish white, or it might have a color. It might be blue, might even be black, but you'll notice there are little points of light within it. There's little sparkling particles. It's said that, you know, scientists who've really looked into darkness have noticed that there is no such thing as absolute darkness, at least not on this planet. That darkness always has these little squibs of light in it. Which one way of understanding that is to realize that the light that is the underpinning of everything is always revealing itself just in little points. So look into the space in front of your eyes and let yourself be present to the sense that what you are seeing with your eyes closed, even if thoughts are coming up or if images are coming up, behind them, underneath them, is this field, which is the substratum of the citta. It may feel small, you know, like it's inside your head. In truth, it's a doorway into the expanded mind and into Prakriti. So allowing the breath to help you do this, let your attention float into the field. Now, when I say let your attention float into the field, I don't mean that you should try to let your body float into the field. It's just your attention. I like to imagine a portal or a wormhole in the space in front of me and let my attention float through it. Because sometimes we create this imaginary barrier which limits the mind to inside the body. So if you can float through this opening, this wormhole, it will take you deeper into the field and you'll begin to realize that you can swim through your mind, your attention, not your body, can, as it were, swim through the mind. Going deeper and deeper with your attention, inhaling and then exhaling. As you exhale, let the energy in the breath propel you into the field of subtle awareness and sensation, as though the exhalation is a very delicate wind that propels you deeper into the field of the mind. Your attention is energy. The mind field is energy. The breath is energy. Just give up trying to hold your attention static and let it flow. Let it move forward to the side. And as you let yourself move through the field, there may be thoughts arising, there may be visual sensations. But you just keep allowing the subtle wind of the breath to propel your attention forward, going deeper and deeper, wider and wider. If you come to a place where you don't feel like you can flow any deeper, imagine that you cut another wormhole, that your attention finds another opening and expands, lets you expand past it. And as your attention flows through the field of the citta, as though you are flowing to a sky or a field of light, you notice that there actually aren't any edges to it. And then if you come up to what feels like an edge, you can move through it by allowing yourself to be, as it were, swallowed, allowing your attention to be swallowed by the energy within it. Let yourself become each successive aspect of the energetic field. Allowing the mind to expand, to become more subtle, a especially to relax, to let go, to surrender into the subtlety of your own mind. If thoughts want to come, bring in the mantric thought, Ahimsa, I am that. I am that luminous energy that is the Shakti field of my own citta, my own mind. At some point, your attention will settle and become still. And perhaps the mantra will go on repeating itself. As this happens, allow the inhalation and exhalation to rise and fall within the field of the mind. And see if you can enjoy the subtle deliciousness that occurs when you're just present within this subtle energy field whose nature is Shakti, which is a form of goddess. Any sensation, any feeling is arising and subsiding within this field. Peaceful flow of breath and mind flows in a kind of undulation. Like the undulation of a deep swell in the ocean. Flowing inward like a tide. Flowing outward. Opening. Notice your state at this point in your practice, and we'll just take a moment so that you can write down anything that you'd like to recall or a question that you'd like to ask. in a certain sense, all meditation practice has as its goal the opening into the expanded mind, the state which is Prakriti, which is Shakti, which is a place of radical power and luminosity. So this meditation is actually a meditation on mind as it really is. Now, you're not trying to bypass it by leaping into the witness. You're letting yourself flow inside the mental universe, the chitta, which is a form of Shakti. And what may start to happen, especially as you practice this more, is that the sense of being a limited personal self starts to dissolve. It becomes less relevant. And it's not that the I sense completely disappears, but it expands, as I was saying last week, to become more universal, so that you become aware that this, the subtle ego, not as something that you identify with, you know, in your empirical body mind, but as the Atman, as the self, as spirit itself. So the more you become one, the more you let your mind tune into its deeper substratum, the more Siddhi begins to become a normal part of your life. And to just say something about the attitude of that has been held by Siddhi, about Siddhis, the thing that it's really important to understand about supernormal powers, psychic powers, superpowers, as we like to call them in the days of, in our time, when the Marvel Universe is a part of our normal discourse, there are almost 40 sutras that talk about Siddhis. Most of Book 3 is about Siddhis. So why is it that Patanjali made such a big deal about them? Especially when he goes on in Sutra 37 to warn that you shouldn't get trapped by them. I mean, what's the issue here? You know, many, many scholars, especially the European Indological scholars who first translated this text into Western languages, just dismissed the whole idea of Siddhis. You know, a lot of them were Christians, and they essentially dismissed Eastern religious, many, many Eastern religious practices as simply superstition because, you know, they were different. But more to the point, most of these commentators held that worldview that began with the Western Enlightenment in the 18th century, which also coincided with the beginning of materialist science. So Siddhis are irrational. You know, they're not subjected to the laws of the universe, the laws of time and space. They literally take us beyond time and space, and that's why for someone who's completely rational, they're hard to believe. And that said, the Indian and Taoist spiritual traditions, that includes the Buddhist and Jain traditions, are filled with descriptions of Siddhis. And you know, they had normal direct experiences of how yogic powers are part of the food of yoga. Swami Vivekananda once described, I think, an adorable encounter with a yogi whom he met when he was hiking in the Himalayas. The yogi lived in a very simple hut. And when Vivekananda came into the hut, the yogi said that he would like to offer him a meal, but had no food in hand. So he said, so describe to me a meal that you enjoyed, that you would like to eat now. So Vivekananda said, well, the best dinner I ever had was at the Palmer House restaurant in Chicago. You know, it was roast beef and roast chicken and potatoes. A minute later, plate full of roast chicken and potatoes, along with a napkin and silverware and glasses engraved with the logo of the Palmer House, appeared on the floor of the hut. And Vivekananda said, it was real food and it tasted good. So somehow this yogi had rearranged the particles of matter, produce an authentic meal from 10,000 miles away. Now, these are, you know, cities like this are kind of tricky you know, their, let's say their tricks. And of course, India is full of people who have acquired cities, and they'll tell you how you acquire cities, and who show off with them. But they're also very, very great beings who were known for creating miracles. One of them was the famous Saint Sai Baba of Shirdi, who was constantly changing the lives and the karmas and the destinies of his students. Someone would come to him and say, "Baba, I've lost my job. Please help me." And he would say, "Give me 2 rupees and money will come to you." That was his protocol. He would always ask for a little bit of money. So the person would give him the rupees, and a couple of days later, he'd be offered a job that was way better than the job he had had before. So someone would, you know, say, "I have cancer." You'd give them a piece of ash with ritual fire, tell them to swallow it, and they would be healed. You know, Shirdi Sai Baba was a great, great, great Siddha master. His siddhis were extraordinary, and there are books of stories of his devotees. I'll tell you an experience of my own. A few years ago, I was very sick with a lung disease, and someone suggested that I visit a venerable Ayurvedic doctor who lives in the U.S. He's Indian, but he has a center in the U.S. And a friend who had studied with him said, you know, you have to understand that there are 2 levels of treatment that he offers. One of them, you know, he'll just diagnose you and give you some herbs, and it'll be just like a regular treatment. But so what you have to do is sit in front of him, go into your heart, connect with his heart, inwardly ask him to heal you. So I did that, and, you know, I closed my eyes. I asked him internally, then I opened my eyes, and I asked, "Am I going to get better?" And he said, "You will be better." And a month later, the disease went into remission. I was completely free of it for about 5 years. So that's a city. That's how you know it's operating. And I would say that on another, you know, on another level, on a, you know, so to speak, normal daily life level, if you practice Reiki or another method of energy healing, you will have felt siddhi operating. You'll have felt healings happening. And of course, in the New Thought universe and science of mind and other modern Western traditions, protocols have been developed that are designed to put the practitioner in touch with the substratum of their own mind that seed an intention into that state. And if you can do it with the kind of awareness that the yoga sutras would call samyama, you can attract the house you want, the job you want, the healing you want. You know, and these protocols, which really are, do come from the yoga sutra, they're very accessible, but they require self-cultivation, which fortunately, I would say most people are not able to do to that extent. So Vivekananda, as most, like most great beings, disapproved of siddhis, as did my guru, not because he didn't believe they were real, but because they just considered them distractions from the real goal of the journey. And as I said, Patanjali says the same thing in verse 37. Siddhis can obstruct your path because you get so fascinated by them, especially some of the really out there ones, which we'll talk about next week, that you don't, you know, that you kind of get stuck there. And, you know, that so, but you're going to have siddhis. All of you are going to have them. They're part of what happens when you meditate. And to know this protocol of using samyama to more deeply understand something, to acquire the power to see into the essence or to experience the essence of something, to heal yourself, are very, very useful. There are several ways of acquiring siddhis. One is through grace, especially if you spend time around an extraordinarily powerful master or have a connection with such a master. When I lived in Swami Muktananda's ashram, it was very normal for us to be given a job to do that we had no training for, that we didn't understand how to do. And we would find that the knowledge of how to do the job, and in fact, skill at it, would just arise spontaneously while we were doing the job, and then it would be gone. You know, I have a friend who redid the plumbing system in his house through the instruction that just came to him in the process. But when Siddhis come through grace, which is, you know, how they do for most of us, how they will for most of you, you don't have too much control over them. The samyama process is meant to give you a kind of deliberate ability to discover them. Another way that Siddhis come is through mantras. You know, in India, there are a lot of mantras that specifically give you particular powers. This is how Satya Sai Baba, the 20th century guru, who claimed to be a reincarnation of Shirdi Sai Baba, acquired the ability to produce ash and jewelry from the air. He did it with mantras. A third way of getting siddhis is through herbs, which I think most people agree probably means hallucinatory drugs. Some people are born with them because of past lives. Some people do tapas, hard austerities, with a desire for outcome. And there are many, many stories about this in the mythological books of India. For instance, it's said that when Parvati, the goddess, wanted to marry Shiva, who would not come out of meditation and pay attention to her, she stood on one leg in a stream, repeating Om Namah Shivaya until the radiance of her practice became so strong that it penetrated into Shiva's meditation and he came for her. And again, there are worldly versions of this kind of tapas, and that's what it takes to solve a difficult math problem or write a book. But the idea behind siddhis, the understanding behind siddhis, is the yogic understanding that when you get in touch with the substratum of experience, with prakriti, you can manipulate physical realities because the subtle always has power over the gross. Or we could say that the higher always holds power over the lower. When you go very deep in meditation, and again, many of you have this experience, you begin to experience the subtle elements, which are called tanmatras, that are the blueprints of what will eventually become physical objects. You know, inner colors, sounds, experiences of inner touches and tastes reveal themselves to us in meditation and dreams. That's what we see when we dream. And we have subtle senses that are activated in dreams and meditation. They allow us to see these forms. And, you know, behind these are the citta, the ahamkara, and the buddhi, and of which the subtlest is the buddhi, the most subtle and awake aspect of the human consciousness. Who did that meditation on, you know, sailing into the stream of the mind, what was operating was the buddhi, which contains our attention and will. And as it becomes more expansive, you begin to be able to, through samyama, make the buddhi one with prakriti, at which point it can manipulate anything. So, you know, if you read these sutras, which I'm assuming that you have or will this week, you know that there are some pretty esoteric ones. You know, they describe a meditation on the sun where you can travel to different subtle worlds, meditations that allow you to see past, present, and future by meditating on the natural changes in matter, where you can see your time of death by doing samyama on signs and portents or visions that you have in dreams. They give you a process for flying, for becoming invisible, for acquiring the strength of an elephant. You know, there are some very esoteric, and most of them to me don't seem that relevant or interesting, but there are a number of them that are actually quite helpful in spiritual life, and especially in meditation. And those are the ones that we're going to talk about a little bit today, a little bit next week, and I'm going to give you some practice for them, for homework. So one of the most significant for us is described in Sutra 18 of Book 3. It says, by bringing strong samskaras into direct perception, you acquire the knowledge of previous births. The sutta says, samskara sakshat karanat purva jati jnanam Jati means birth. Jnana means knowledge. Samskara sakshat means direct perception of samskaras. So how do you do it? You do it by meditating, by creating intense focus on some of your deeper samskaras. And, you know, like, okay, suppose you have an illness that won't go away, and you want to understand why it won't go away and how to heal it. So you might meditate on the sensations of the illness, on the states of mind that arise about it, especially on the thoughts you have about it. You know, if one way you know that an illness is related to past life conditions is that it will seem very familiar and it will probably prove difficult to heal. And then you might ask yourself, as you contemplate the pain or the weakness in the organ or the feeling that comes up around the illness, you might ask yourself, what does this disease want me to know? Where does it come from? What past life experience does it connect to? And you'll begin to get insight. You know, it's the deeper you go into it, the more insight will come. And you want to meditate on it in as thought-free a state as possible so that the insights aren't just something you're making up. I used to have a chronic neck and throat condition, which has pretty much been healed. I mean, I had it for 35 or 40 years. And at one point, I began to do samyama on my neck and throat. And one day, as I was doing this, I started to see scene after scene, battlefield scenes, in which I was in a man's body, being stabbed in the neck, shot in the throat, decapitated. And in a lot of these dreams, and they weren't dreams, a lot of these visions, I would realize how many lifetimes most of us have spent in battles, in wars, being soldiers, you know, undergoing violent deaths. It gave me a perspective on my karmic past that actually explained a lot of things about my temperament. I have a friend who was in an abusive romantic relationship and could not get herself to leave. And one day she began to meditate on the felt sense of her connection to this man and ask the question, why can't I leave him? And she had just a flash of a vision, which she saw them in medieval clothes. She was extremely pregnant. He came into the room and she saw that he had been away at war, and she'd become pregnant by another man. And it was the guilt, the pain of that encounter that kept her feeling that she had to stay with him no matter how he treated her, and of course probably made him treat her the way he did it. Some scatters of our past actions and emotions are stored in the deepest layers of the citta. They emerge as memories, obviously mostly memories of this life, but also as drivers of your life experience, as you know. Because they're recorded in your subtle memory, in your karmashaya, as it's called, when you retrieve a past life memory, it will often come up with information about when and where it was. My guru, I used to say, and other great beings have said, that when you are on the road to self-realization, at a certain point, you will see at least 7 of your past lifetimes. You can also use this same practice of meditating on samskaras to understand the origin of strong habitual feelings like jealousy or anger. And, you know, or suppose you meet someone that you're strongly drawn to and begin to contemplate your relationship and why you're so attracted to them or why they feel familiar. You may become aware of a past life connection. Or, you know, if there's a strong desire or ambition, like the desire to have children or to visit a certain place, as you imagine the desired outcome, the feeling of being there, you might recall that it's a place or a person that you've been connected with in the past. And the same is true about the obstructions that you experience. If you meditate on, you know, for instance, the feeling of not being loved, for instance, or the feeling of not being able to go as deep in meditation as you would like, you may become aware of a past life experience that is being purified, and also become aware that as you go through the, you know, as you surrender to the fact that you have this past life experience that you're carrying now, that the tendency will, if you approach it with the right attitude, that the tendency will actually leave you. It can be helpful to understand past karmas because it can help you understand things about your life. And it can allow you to make more conscious choices, to recognize that there are aspects of inner work that are necessary for you because you are working with tendencies that have been there for a while, for lifetimes. And because understanding your karmas is not supposed to turn you into a passive fatalist, but to help you recognize the areas of choice and the areas of surrender. And samyama on your samskaras will start to show you how to deal with them, how to work with them, how to let them go. And I want to say also that when you meditate on samskaras and start to see your past karmas, it can also show you something about the wheel of karma and how ineluctable it is. It can give you a lot of motivation for practice. So let's take a couple of deep breaths in and exhale. And another deep breath in. Now allowing the breath to come through the nostrils and touch the soft palate. Flow into the center of your head with the inhalation and down towards the heart. We're going to practice with Sutra 23, which is one of the most significant and helpful Samyama Sutras in this whole part of the text. The Sanskrit of Sutra 23 of Book 3 says, Maitri Sadeshu Balani, by Samyama on friendliness and such qualities, strengths are acquired. This sutta refers to what in Buddhism is called the paramitas, the qualities like that, that we can cultivate to purify the mind. They, you know, Patanjali talks about that in Book 1, verse 33. These qualities are friendliness towards those who are happy, compassion towards those who are suffering, joy towards those who are experiencing spiritual uplift, and equanimity towards the wicked. Friendliness allows you to enjoy others' happiness without jealousy. Compassion, which is the one we're going to meditate on now, allows you to hold space for people who are suffering without yourself being brought down by their suffering that you want to turn away from them. Joy towards those who are experiencing spiritual uplift, which is truly one of the most joyous things in the world, without comparing yourself to them and thinking that there's something wrong with you because you're not having that experience. And equanimity towards the wicked, because your equanimity towards those who are disrupting, you know, our society will actually help you stay clear in that process. Doing samyama on these practices can transform your mind so that your mind and heart become so permeated with these qualities that they flow out from you and affect others. And really the power in samyama is its ability to draw out the innate abilities that are in your extended citta. And the powers of friendliness and compassion and joy are within you. They're innate. They're there if we can find them. So let's take a moment to contemplate compassion. Here you can begin by stationing your attention in that spot about 12 inches in front of the body, opposite the heart center. You know, that this place outside the physical body is actually an entrance point into the subtle body, which, as many of you know, surrounds the physical body.
Hey, Sally, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yes.
I think we'll have to have you restart. Your audio is, we're getting some pops, and you're going in and out. So I might need you to dial back in.
Good. I'll dial back in, sweetie. Okay.
All right.
Thank you, everybody.
Everybody stay in line. Thank you.
Hopefully this is better. This is okay. Deb, is it okay?
Yes, it sounds better.
Okay. We have been talking about meditation on samskaras, which allows us to actually discover our past karmas and very often the ways to cultivate qualities in ourselves that allow us to move through our karmas. I will include this material in the homework so you can read it and practice with it. One of the homework contemplation assignments will be on how you meditate on a samskara, a strong samskara, to see if it's possible to really find the origin of it. And this protocol is not about trying to figure anything out. It's actually a practice of samyama, of strong focus on the feeling of the samskara, with the question, what is the origin of this and how can it be shifted or changed? So we'll be doing that as a homework assignment. And we were just beginning to talk about Sutra 23, which is the process of doing samyama on qualities like friendliness, joy, compassion, and equanimity, which, as we know, are four of the most skillful character-changing processes, practices that the Yoga Sutra talks about. What I was saying was that samyama on those practices actually transforms the mind, that it works directly on the quality of your consciousness. It's a way of eliminating aversion and hatred. It's a way of allowing your mind and heart to become so permeated with these sattvic, beautiful qualities that they can flow out from you. They become part of who you are, and other people experience the gifts of them. As I was saying, the power in samyama is its ability to draw out innate qualities, you know, qualities that are intrinsic to our consciousness, to our prakriti, and which, once we understand that they're part of us, the samyama practice helps us make them manifest within us. So let's take a moment to contemplate compassion. We were saying earlier in class that when you feel sympathy or the desire to be helpful to another person, it's very, very skillful to do it from the place of compassion rather than empathy. And as we begin this meditation, take a moment to flow with the breath, allowing the breath to come in through the nostrils, down to the heart, and then feel that the exhalation flows out from the heart as though there were an opening in the chest wall. Of course, it's actually flowing through the nostrils, but we're going to practice with this understanding. And become aware of this space. It's about 12 inches in front of the body. And it you might just want to place your hand for a moment, place your hand about 12 inches in front of the body. Just, you know, intuitively find the space. And notice that if you get very sensitive to the feeling there, that there's a kind of an energy center. You can feel a certain intensity of the energy here. So begin to inhale and exhale as though the breath were coming from that spot. You can keep your hand there for a minute or two if you want, or just let it come down to your lap as you start to get a sense of where that spot is. The breath comes in from that spot, it goes out to that spot. And as you inhale and exhale with the sense that the breath is entering your body from this area, become more and more aware that you're in your subtle body, in the heart center, but outside the emotional body. Eckhart Tolle talks about the experience, the web of experience that he calls the pain body, which is the accumulated samskaras of suffering that you've learned to identify with. And normally when you come across a suffering person, it activates our own pain body. So by stationing yourself in this region of the outer heart, you can hold space for suffering without triggering your own pain, and you can do it for your own suffering as well as for somebody else. So breathing in and out of the outer heart, begin to dwell on this quality of compassion. Compassion is a feeling of immense openness, where you're able to feel the poignancy of human experience, the ways in which we're so vulnerable, the ways in which our experience can be painful or joyful, but is always underlaid with this sense of our fragility and our frailty as human creatures, and how all the mistakes we make and all the pain we go through are expressions of this fundamental quality of vulnerability, which is so much a part of life in a body, and which is both the quality that causes suffering and also the quality that is an expression of our deep beauty. So in compassion, we're aware of the vulnerability in ourselves or another person as a very beautiful aspect of embodied life. And we're able to hold a wish for healing or for happiness from that place of recognizing the fundamental connection. Of our human vulnerability and of our human connection to each other. And you might want to think of examples of compassion, the expression in the eyes of the Dalai Lama, which is very powerful for many people, the basic tenderness that might come up in you when you look at a baby. And notice that tenderness can morph into pity, which is painful and which creates distance. But that tenderness can also morph into compassion, which is a very quiet, loving energy that always contains a feeling of equality with the other person. Because in compassion, there's a recognition that what another person experiences could also just as easily be yours. And in compassion, there's a desire to help, which doesn't contain any striving, but does contain the recognition that because awareness connects us all, because love connects us all. We can hold space for another person or for ourselves. And without expectation, create the space for healing to occur. So as you breathe in and out of the heart space, imagine yourself filled with compassion. Use your imagination to contemplate, how does compassion walk? How does compassion look at another person? How does compassion see my own flaws and weaknesses? How does compassion eat? See if you can bring this sense of compassion into your body and feel it filling you with its unique tenderness and spaciousness. Now turn your attention to someone you know who's experiencing hardship or grief or misfortune, or somebody who behaves in a way that you have trouble with. And again, find the feeling of compassion in yourself. Feel that as you breathe in and out of this space of compassion in front of the heart, that your awareness is literally opening to include this person. And here you may want to use words, especially the words of the loving kindness practice that most of us have done at some point. May this person's health improve. May their sadness dissolve. May they find satisfying work. May they experience love. Find the positive wishes that you wish to share with this person. And then with your breath coming in and out of the space in front of the heart, feel that you are literally holding an open spaciousness that includes this person and also yourself. And if any feelings are arising, anything from deep tenderness to a feeling of not being able to do the practice, hold them all in this open spaciousness. Let the breath flow in and out from the center in front of the body, using words, may this person be happy. May they be healthy. May they be loved. May they accept themselves. We're going to sit with this feeling of compassion doing some yama on the space in front of the heart, on the feeling that arises when you wish well for another person. You may bring yourself into the meditation with the feeling, the felt sense, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I be loving, may I be loved, may I be healed. You can expand it to another person, to anyone who comes into your attention, but your focus should not be so much on the thoughts as on the felt sense of open compassion, of holding space, tender space for another person, for yourself, and of course for the world. As you slip away from the felt sense of compassion, notice that there are words that seem to kindle it. May I experience compassion. May this person in my life feel loved. May the inequities in this planet be healed, whatever it is. And to amplify this meditation on compassion, imagine that within you is one of the great beings whose grace and compassion has been sung about through the centuries. Christ or Buddha, or someone that you know whose compassion fills you when you think of them. Or imagine that goddess, that Ishwara, that the divine being whom we call the personal form of God, is living under your skin and looking through your eyes, looking with total love. So that the person you're contemplating or anyone else who comes into your mind is seen through the eyes of compassionate love. Let yourself accept yourself as one who carries the compassion of the infinite. Inhaling from the space in front of your heart, exhaling into it. Take into yourself the understanding that you actually are the essence of compassion. Any tiny moment of feeling that open tenderness is going to affect every particle of your body and is going to flow through your pores. So see if when you open your eyes and go into your evening or into your day, ask yourself, how does compassion walk? How does compassion talk to other people? How does compassion touch the food I eat? How does compassion look at the objects in this room and the people I see? Let yourself carry this focus, this dharana, dhyana, samadhi, into the day. So that your samyama on compassion begins to become the practice for this moment. And you might want to spend a minute or two writing down the insights that arose or the experience. If questions have come up, please write them down, because we're going to have a Q&A session on Sunday. Deb will send you an invitation. And your homework will be coming along with an audio of this particular meditation. And the audio for this call will be available tomorrow as well. So thank you so much. Namaste. So much love to you all.